This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
What happened this week and why? That is the Friday show today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Friday today, the 11th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So much to talk about this week. So very little time, so here we go. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. Obviously, we will begin with the CPI numbers out yesterday. Way better than anybody had been guessing, you know, 7.7% year-on-year for the headline number as was digested yesterday in the news cycle. Does this take the Feds back a little bit away from the wall now, maybe?
I'm sure the general numbers were things that the Fed wanted to see. You know, Chairman Powell at his most recent press conference had indicated that there was a willingness to slow down the pace of rate hikes mm-hmm. going forward, but, you know, not take their eye off the ball or anything. But maybe there would be a less aggressive period of rate hikes, starting possibly next month. And I think this report certainly supports that story, given that it looks like inflationary pressures are not quite as bad as they have been. That said, they're still too high. Mm-hmm. And there are some signs in here that were disconcerting, including the fact, for example, that shelter costs had mm-hmm. their highest monthly gain since, I think, 1990. And services inflation hasn't really shown a sign of slowing. So it's not all hunky-dory. But yes, in general, I think that the headline numbers are ones that the Fed wanted to see.
Well, Anna, you know, just to pick up on Catherine's point about services inflation, right? It is now in services where the prices are still elevated, right, as opposed to goods early in this whole mess. And 7.7%, as I think Susan Collins, the new head of the Boston Fed, said yesterday, 7.7% is nobody's idea of stable prices.
Yeah. I mean, services inflation is not showing much sign of slowing. And I think that is something the Fed is watching very carefully. Inflation is kind of gradually spread from goods into services, which includes entertainment and travel, but also things like shelter, medical yeah. care. And those prices are really more tied into wages, which have been rising a lot in recent months. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of high profile layoffs at Twitter and other mm-hmm. tech companies. Mm-hmm. recently, but overall the labor market still seems pretty strong, and so does consumer demand for services. Services inflation can be really sticky, can be really hard to reverse. So there is a worry that that's going to feed overall inflation for some time to come, despite this kind of better headline number that we just saw.
So Catherine, do you think this means that what the Fed has been doing has been working, or did the Fed, for lack of a better phrase, just kind of get lucky and things were kind of tapering themselves?
Was this an immaculate disinflation or whatever the term is? Well, look, the Fed is definitely having an effect on certain categories like housing, right? I mean, you've already started to see house sales prices, I should say, those have come down a little bit. So it's not like it's had no effect. Certainly, tightening financial conditions do seem to be putting somewhat of a damper on these price pressures and on demand a little bit. So the challenge is that monetary policy works with a really long lag, and it will be very hard to judge just how effective these rate hikes are or have been until long after the fact, because it just takes a while for them to take their full effect. You know, we won't know if they raise them too much or too little, too quickly or too, I mean, probably nobody thinks that they raise them too slowly going in, but going forward, who knows?
Yeah. So Anna, let's change gears here just a little bit, sort of, change the focus, I guess. So the G20 is this weekend, President Biden, and newly reinstalled President of China, Xi Jinping, meet for the first time face to face at the G20. It comes as China today, I think, I've been traveling, I don't know if it was late yesterday or today, announced some tweaks. They didn't do away with it, but they announced some tweaks to the zero COVID policy. What are you expecting to come out of this meeting, if anything?
So, honestly, I think, you know, out of the meeting, we're likely to see few of what people in Washington love to call deliverables. You know, they're supposed to talk about the war in Ukraine, trade, human rights, North Korea. But I think the most important outcome is just ensuring that this relationship between the world's two most powerful economies is stable and not going off the rails. And, you know, often that means Taiwan, which Biden has been pretty forceful about in his statements. I do think the COVID zero restrictions are really interesting, potentially really important for the global economy if China is starting to ease some of those. I mean, it's really early days, but, you know, if China reopens, that means that global supply chains kind of get pumping again. That helps to resolve some shortages. But it also means that demand within China for all kinds of goods and materials and energy just starts to surge because, you know, restaurants have been closed down. Yeah. Their consumption of vegetable oil is down like a quarter. So that could really help to push up prices globally as well.
I will say that our China correspondent did a long visit to the States, Jennifer Pack, and she just now has headed back, and she's in the middle of like a 10-day quarantine, and she's putting it on her Instagram, and it looks kind of pretty grim. But on a riff on that for a little while, right? Because what zero COVID has meant for the global supply chain is nothing good.
No, it's difficult to get your products out. The Chinese government has tried to keep things moving smoothly, but, you know, of course, when you have all these stops and starts, it's going to impact things. It's also meant that, you know, most global business people haven't been to China in years because, you know, they don't have time for the quarantine. They're afraid of getting caught up. So it's really walled China off from the global economy. And then it also has really clamped down on domestic demand within China, which is a huge driver of global growth as well and trade.
Yeah. All right, Catherine, last word to you. And I want to ask, it's a little geeky, it's a little dorky, but consumer sentiment came out this week. I want to ask you about inflation expectations because they tweak up just a hair. Are you worried about that? I mean, you watch that pretty closely.
Look, it's not a good sign. Yeah. This is exactly what the Fed is very worried about, that they're worried that inflation expectations will essentially become a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if people start to anticipate higher prices, then they go out and buy more stuff, which drives prices up. They raise their own prices, et cetera. It's a vicious cycle. That's not what they want to see. That said, this was a very tiny tick upward. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's anything worth panicking about at this point, but yeah, it's unhelpful. It's bizarre also because prices, as we've just discussed, prices themselves rose less than people had expected in October. So then why do you see these forward-looking projections moving in the wrong direction?
Why, oh why? The theme of the broadcast today. Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post and Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, hey, do you remember yesterday's crazy spike? I'm sure Amy told you about that while I was out. Yeah, this was not that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are just today wrapping up week two of the richest man in the world doing whatever it is that he's doing to Twitter. And I will assume you're already as up to speed as you care to be on the whole roller coaster ride of mass layoffs, $8 a month check marks, and all the rest of that. But there is a whole nother part of this story that's not getting as much attention as all of the roller coaster rides. Yes, Musk paid $44 billion to buy Twitter. We know that. But that wasn't all his money. He borrowed $13 billion of it to help foot the bill. And Bloomberg News is reporting that the banks that lent him that money are now trying to offload those loans and offload them quick, too, at discounts as low as 60 cents on the dollar. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the leveraged buyout desk today.
It's actually pretty standard for a bank to sell off loans it made to help buy a company. In fact, that's often the point, says Drew Pascarella, senior lecturer of finance at Cornell University.
Banks generally make loans with the thought in mind that they would eventually sell at least a portion of those loans to other investors.
Pascarella says by this point, banks have already collected their fees, and they don't want to keep too much of their cash tied up with one company. Plus, there are plenty of other investors that might be interested in taking on those loans.
Hedge funds and private investors, you know, that are looking to, you know, generate return for their investors or themselves by way of the yield on these loans.
But what's unusual about this deal are the steep discounts those potential buyers are offering. 60 cents on the dollar? That's not the norm, says Matteo Arena, finance professor at Marquette University.
Usually you see discounts, you know, 90 cents on a dollar, maybe 85 cents on a dollar.
Arena says those potential buyers, the hedge funds and private investors, are worried. What if Twitter's advertising revenue totally dries up? What if Twitter goes bankrupt?
If the company goes bankrupt, how much of the money we're lending we're going to be able to get back in court?
These kinds of questions are on the table because of what's been happening at Twitter lately.
You don't usually have a company lay off half of its employees within a week.
That's Afra Sharipour, a law professor at UC Davis. She says most people who borrow to buy companies typically take some time after an acquisition to work with their lenders and figure out how they want to restructure the company.
And the hopes that they turn around the business and they sell it to somebody else or they take it public.
Either way, she says there are probably plenty of investors who'd be willing to buy these loans if they believe in Twitter's future or if that debt is dirt cheap. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Two things you need to know about Amazon on the way into this next story. Number one, they advertise on this program. And number two, ticker symbol AMZN, while up to date, as was tech more broadly, Amazon is still off more than 40% the last 12 months, 40%. And the Wall Street Journal reports CEO Andy Jassy is looking to cut costs where he can. Amazon's got good company doing that, of course. Meta's laying off 11,000 people. Google and a bunch of others are slowing their hiring. So we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler how Amazon might be planning for the downside risk.
Amazon's senior leadership team regularly reviews its investment outlook and financial performance. That's what the company said in a statement today. It added, as part of this year's review, we're of course taking into account the current macro environment and considering opportunities to optimize costs. That's all well and good, says Gene Munster at Loop Ventures, a tech investment company, but he says this one feels different.
This review has some investment areas that have been kind of core to the company over the past 5 years. Some of those areas are under more of a microscope, which is different than a typical review.
Investment areas like Alexa and brick-and-mortar retail outlets. But Brendan Witcher, a principal analyst at Forrester, says the story isn't just about Amazon trying to cut costs.
The story is more about watch how they cost cut and watch how it'll likely be probably more lightweight than you would expect.
Witcher says historically, Amazon has been good about not overcutting, whether it's in investments or jobs. He says that's because the company understands it's so big now that cuts in one area will almost certainly affect others. And to be clear, Amazon isn't the only firm talking about cutting costs right now.
I think the clock has struck midnight for big tech in terms of hyper growth.
Dan Ives is a managing director at Wedbush Securities.
It's not just Amazon. You're seeing it for Apple, Microsoft, of course, Meta. This is really Amazon being cautious ahead of what looks like a dark storm cloud coming in terms of this recession.
Which is something Arun Sundaram at research firm CFRA says shareholders want to hear.
Investors want to see companies like Amazon kind of tighten their belt and prepare for a slower economic growth in 2023.
As part of that belt tightening, in August, Amazon said it was closing its telehealth unit, Amazon Care. And just last week, the company announced a hiring freeze across corporate jobs. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it just felt like nobody could really spend money anymore.
The job market ghosts of recessions past. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials found 32 points, about a 10%, 33,747. The Nasdaq lifted 209 points, 1.8%, 11,323. The S&P 500 added 36 points, about 0.9%. 39,992. There for the week, the Dow picked up 4.1%. The Nasdaq gained 8.1%. 8.1%. That is not a typo. The S&P 500 grew 5.9%. One of the banks that helped finance Elon Musk's $44 billion Twitter buyout, Morgan Stanley, shares up 2.2%. Today, another is Bank of America, which tacked on 0.7%. Mr. Euler had the story of Amazon taking a hard look at its product line to see where it might trim things back. Amazon delivered 4.3% today. Shares of language learning company Duolingo sank 13%. For its latest quarter, revenue fell a bit short of expectations, but it did report a smaller than expected loss and boosted the outlook for the full year. The U.S. bond market was closed today for Veterans Day. I should have taken the day off, actually, right? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. About the only story in the news cycle this week that's been moving faster than Elon Musk and the defenestration of Twitter is in crypto, where the collapse of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which a week ago was the darling of crypto, but which today filed for bankruptcy protection, its collapse has been both speedy and spectacular. Spectacular in a terrible, a whole lot of people are going to lose a whole lot of money kind of way. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, there aren't a whole lot of places for those people to turn, not even the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which gets consumer crypto complaints all the time.
The CFPB says most of the complaints involve fraud, including pig butchering, a romance scam where hackers get victims' trust, set up crypto accounts, then empty them. You can scroll through the complaints on the CFPB website. Here's a sampling voiced by some of my Marketplace colleagues.
All my funds disappeared.
The mining page was a fraudulent mirrored page of another company. It was a scam.
I wired money to a person who was going to invest it in crypto. It was transferred to Bitcoin, then sent to his crypto wallet. Please help. I'm devastated.
But at this point, there's not a lot the government can do. There just aren't many regulations covering crypto investments. Mark Hayes is with the nonpartisan consumer group Americans for Financial Reform. He says right now, it's buyer beware.
These products are fundamentally being provided as a speculative investment opportunity, and consumers should know that.
But Hayes says some current regulations should be extended to cover crypto firms.
If they're providing bank-like products like deposits or accounts, they should be regulated like banks.
Some companies in the crypto space say they are open to more regulation. Farouk Malik is CEO of Rain, a software firm that transfers crypto onto corporate credit cards. He says different regulations are needed, though, for unique crypto products like NFTs. In the meantime, he says crypto consumers should educate themselves and take charge of their own funds.
What that means is that you have a wallet which is on the blockchain. You can hold your own assets within the wallet and your blockchain.
Malik says when you rely on third parties to move your crypto around, you expose yourself to all kinds of scams. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's talk about memory for a minute. Memory and milestones. You remember your first kiss, right? The first bad breakup, too, probably. Maybe the first time you drove a car, the first president you voted for. What about your first recession? If you were a brand new college graduate just entering the workforce in, say, 1982 or 1991 or 2008, you probably got real vivid memories of what that was like. Because research tells us that if you graduate into a recession, your employment prospects and your wages are going to be hit for at least a decade, maybe more. Now, to be clear, we are not in a recession. But next year? Maybe. So Marketplace's Matt Levin went in search of advice for the class of 2023.
It's reunion day at the UC Davis School of Law up in Northern California. A pretty even mix of baby boomers and Gen Xers and millennial lawyers are milling about the buffet line for crudité and bacon wrap something. Class of 82 graduate Cheryl Gertler has that squinty look of, I think I know you. Do I know you?
I can't recognize anybody, but a lot of gray and white hair here, so I'm not sure anymore.
For all the glib memes about how easy and cheap everything was for baby boomers, the unlucky ones like Gertler, who started their careers in the early 80s, faced a gnarly economy.
Low wages and not being able to purchase very much. People were not buying things. I remember visiting my parents up in Oregon, and it just felt like nobody could really spend money anymore.
Inflation was high, like today. But very unlike today, the unemployment rate was over 10%. Gertler gave up pretty quickly on her job search.
And then I decided to go to Japan and study the Japanese culture and study the language.
By the time she returned to the U.S. in the mid-80s, the economy was recovering. And every law firm wanted lawyers who could land clients from an emerging economic giant in East Asia.
Fortunately, because I had Japan all over my resume, I was all of a sudden very marketable.
Gertler likes her life now as an immigration attorney in L.A., but if she could turn back time, would she choose a different year to come out of law school?
See, for me, I would not, because had I graduated in a different time when there was more jobs, I would not have had the guts to go do what I did.
The Reagan-era good times Gertler returned to stopped abruptly in the early 90s. Unemployment peaked at 7% in 1992 when Chancellor Al-Mansour was deciding what type of lawyer she wanted to be, corporate law or civil rights.
At that time, I remember thinking I missed the boat because I graduated in 92.
She says the bad economy and the discrimination she experienced in interviews tipped the scales towards her heart. She now directs a fair housing nonprofit. Every now and then, she does fantasize about what it would be like if she graduated a few years later in the mid to late 90s boom.
Anytime I went to a big event and all this, and they'd look at me and they'd say, oh, what do you do? I'm a civil rights attorney. Oh, of course you're a civil rights attorney. You're black. Every once in a while, I would like to say, well, you know, I'm a major corporate attorney with a blah, 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 blah.
But she also wouldn't want to change the year she graduated.
I don't know if I would have been as needed in any other time.
Sure, there's sample bias here. If you hate how your career turned out, there's not much appeal to seeing all your successful classmates at the reunion. But the whole recessions have a silver lining thing? There's empirical research that backs it up.
So recession graduates tend to be happier with their jobs both early in their careers as well as a long time later.
Emily Bianchi is a professor at Emory University's business school.
The odds are when you land that first job, you're going to be incredibly relieved. You're probably going to feel a sense of gratitude. That sense endures.
Of course, not every recession is created equal. With all due respect to previous generations, millennials of a certain age will remind you there's a reason they called it the Great Recession and not the recession that was pretty much like all the other recessions.
I worked in retail, Eddie Bauer. So, you know, I provided exceptional customer service. Let me tell you, that's not what I went to college for.
Thomas Duda is a current UC Davis Law School student. He finished his undergrad work in 2008 when the financial crisis hit. Duda has a job lined up for next year in employment law, which he picked partly because it's less vulnerable to economic downturns. And it sounds like he, too, wouldn't want to change what year he graduates law school, but for a different reason.
I'm hopefully getting in at just the right moment in time, right before the door closes.
Duda's advice for the next generation entering their first recession? Take a job, any job. It's how you build your skills and your resilience. Eddie Bauer is always hiring. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, President Biden is in Egypt today, gave a big speech. You might have heard about this at the big United Nations climate conference over there, during which the president, as presidents do, talked up his administration's climate successes, which, you know, fair enough. But then he said this.
Folks, we're proving that good climate policy is good economic policy.
That is probably not universally politically popular. But it is kind of the future. All right, we are going, but here is your moment of economic context. Shares of the pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly fell 4.5% today. Why, I hear you ask? Because somebody with $8 and a couple of images of the official company logo paid Elon Musk to get a verified account. And then yesterday afternoon, that account, which was verified but not really verified, tweeted out that insulin was free. Funny? I mean, yeah, I guess so. But 4.5% taken off a company with a $334 billion market capitalization? Pretty soon you're talking real money. It's all fun and games, right? Till somebody gets hurt. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarbrough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.